WKAR with Current State. Are you or someone you know on Medicaid? We start with a bill that may soon require thousands of Michiganders to find jobs in order to keep Medicaid. WKAR's Reginald Hardwick has more.
Now let's deep dive into a bill that moved quickly through the Michigan Senate this week. It would require future able-bodied Medicaid recipients to complete an average of 29 hours per week of work, job training, or education. Thousands of Michiganders could be affected. Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth covered this story and joins me now. Hello, Shayna.
Hello, Reginald.
So what are the specifics of this bill?
So you kind of outlined them pretty well. There would be this requirement. You'd have to either go to school, complete job training, or be working for an average of 29 hours a week. This doesn't apply to everybody. So the kind of key is, what does able-bodied mean? And there are some people who would be disqualified. So pregnant people are not considered able-bodied. People who are over a certain age are not considered able-bodied. And also people with disabilities would not fall under this change. And then there are also ways for people to get a waiver. So for example, if you're a caretaker of somebody with a disability, you could potentially qualify for a waiver. If you have children under the age of 6 years old, you could also potentially qualify for a waiver. However, a lot of opponents to the legislation are saying, look, there are not enough exemptions in this bill, that there are too many people who would end up losing their health coverage anyway, even though maybe they are, you know, taking care of kids who are older than 6 years old, or they're not fully disabled under the qualifications of the bill, but they still shouldn't be required to work. The bill sponsor, Senator Mike Shirkey, who's a Republican, you know, he heard a lot of these complaints sort of as it was going through the committee process and then as it was being debated on the House floor. And this is kind of his thoughts about the bill.
My estimates, I haven't got real numbers from the department yet, but my estimates are there's going to be about 300,000 people out of the 2.3 million on Medicaid that this might apply to. So, you know, the inference is that, you know, the sky's falling and the world's going to come to an end, you know, I think are a bit overplayed. I understand the opposition. I understand the inertia to change. But this really is, at the bottom line, it's not about saving money for the state. It's about securing funds for those who really need it.
Shayna, you talked to a woman who is on Medicaid and says she'll have to make a tough decision if this bill becomes law.
Claire Mader, she is 62 years old. She watches her two grandsons while their parents are at work. She says she also volunteers, and she's currently on Medicaid. She doesn't qualify for Medicare yet. She's got a few years before then. And she essentially says that if you make her choose between taking care of her grandsons and health insurance, that she would pick taking care of her grandsons. And she spoke to the committee and sort of pled her case and said, you know, I'm one of these people that would be left behind if you pass this bill. And this is what she had to say afterwards.
And so while, yes, there are some people who could be working, who aren't working, I think that the vast majority of people in my position would argue, like, you're not considering the full picture.
Here in Michigan, where does this legislation stand right now?
It just passed the state Senate. It was a mainly partisan vote with the Democrats voting against. There was one Republican who did cross over and vote against it. So now it's headed for the state House. It will have to go through a committee hearing before it can be voted on in the full House. And then it would have to go to the governor. And that's where Republicans could actually maybe hit their biggest roadblock, because the governor has come out and said that, he, you know, particularly as it's written right now, he does not support it. And that could potentially lead us to yet another veto override from the Republican-controlled legislature.
Thank you, Shayna, for reporting this story and joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's WKAR's Current State. Students at Michigan State University are once again ramping up calls for its Board of Trustees to step down. The student newspaper is taking the leaders to task for how they're handling the aftermath of the Larry Nassar abuse scandal. WKAR's Reginald Hardwick speaks with State News Editor-in-Chief.
The headline reads, "Trustees, you're done. You are no longer the leaders of MSU. It is time you make room for those who should be." The State News, the newspaper published by Michigan State University students, issued that scathing editorial during this week's issue. And joining me in studio is State News Editor-in-Chief Rachel Fredette. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In the first line, the editorial board wrote, "Nothing has changed since Luana K. Simon resigned from her position as MSU president nearly 4 months ago." Could you elaborate for me?
So when we write these editorials, we try and give a really good perspective of what the students and obviously right now the survivors are feeling. And I think all of that kind of reached a point where we met and we discussed this and we thought about how we've seen things go for these past few months. And I think we can say, you know, for what we do and what we watch, that the students are not happy. And therefore, we kind of have to be their voice and say what we think we've seen. And we haven't seen a lot of change.
Was there a moment or a statement by one or all of the trustees that made your newspaper believe there's no point of return? Was there a moment where the straw broke the camel's back?
Yeah, going back to kind of what we've heard from students and the survivors, I think looking at last week's board meeting on Friday, what we noticed is that they weren't really prepared for the amount of people that were going to be speaking to them. There was a lot of, you know, allegations. But I think what we've noticed is just over these past few months, they haven't really seemed prepared with a lot that's been going on. There's been statements made or there's been issues with whistleblowing certain people. I mean, it's just kind of been all over the place. And I think that's kind of what we were trying to get at, is that they don't seem prepared to be handling this. And that's why we were kind of proposing that there should be a change in leadership.
The editorial board also wrote, "The idea of having you choose our next president after you chose John Engler as interim president is simply terrifying." So why didn't the editorial board ask for Engler to step down?
I think that was actually something we really thought about, because it's something that we've been hearing from the students and as their voice and, you know, kind of trying to put that together into the editorial. What we noticed is that Engler was appointed by the board. The board has, you know, the power there, and that's kind of what we think is the bigger story there. The more important part of this is that if we're going to have a true change in leadership, if we're going to see MSU go in a different direction, which is what the students want to see and what the survivors want to see and the faculty, if we're going to see that, we need to see a different board. And I think that's what we were trying to get at, is because they appointed Engler, and that's the power that they hold. So we wanted to make sure to address them.
Have you had any reaction from the administration or any of the trustees?
We haven't seen any reaction. I don't think we will. We usually do not on our other editorials. I mean, they get asked about it, but no, they probably won't release a statement or anything. And that's all right. We were talking to the students, and I think that's what we were trying to get at.
And what kinds of reaction are you receiving from students?
I think the students are, I wouldn't say excited, but I think they read the editorial and they feel as if that they're being heard, that we were able to take something and kind of encapsulate what has been happening over these past few months. And I would hope that we did that, because, you know, as the state news, we advertise that we're their independent voice. And if we're not representing that, then we're not really doing our jobs.
Well, thank you, Rachel, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking with Rachel Fredette, editor-in-chief of the state news, published by MSU students, and the paper's editorial demanding all MSU Board of Trustees resign. We have a link to the article on WKAR.org. Reginald Hardwick, WKAR News.
It's Current State here on WKAR. Founder of the Me Too movement, Tarana Burke, spoke at the Wharton Center last night as part of the Transformative Justice Speaker Series. WKAR's Katie Cook explains Burke specifically addressed the issues at MSU following the Nassar abuse scandal.
A steady flow of people moved through the lobby of the Wharton Center Thursday to hear Tarana Burke's message about the origins of the Me Too movement and the pervasiveness of sexual violence in American culture.
It's a really important time that she's here at MSU, and maybe I'll learn ways in which I can become a better activist in my community.
This has changed a lot in terms of how I think and how I'm talking to my boys and talking to my daughter and thinking about things. So this is a great moment.
It's very important to keep this movement going, and especially after the events that followed here at MSU.
That was Liz Selby, Jeff Ray, and Natalie Elliott. Tarana Burke's invitation to MSU came before the Larry Nassar case was a national story. But with the school still dealing with the fallout of such a scandal, she received several questions in a press conference ahead of her talk about how MSU can move forward.
The school would have to start by listening to what people are saying, really listening, right? Not paying lip service to it, not just having like a town hall meeting and letting people get up and rant and rave or whatever, but like take some real measures of accountability. What does it look like when you allow students to come into the process?
Burke also said she wants to leave people with an understanding that the movement is not about targeting anyone in a so-called witch hunt, but is about the survivors who collectively spoke out and need healing. For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
From Starbucks to Kendrick Lamar to a trip to Turkey, there's much more ahead on Current State. Stay with us. Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Peter Wharf. It's been a week of contrasting moments for many in the African American community. Reginald Hardwick talks with two guests about two headlines you heard in the news. Tell me what you gonna do to me. Confrontation ain't nothing new to me. You can bring a bullet, bring a sword, bring a morgue, but you can't bring the truth to me. You were just listening to Kendrick Lamar and SZA from the Black Panther soundtrack. It's been an interesting week to be black in America. On one hand, Kendrick Lamar was recognized with one of America's most prestigious honors in literature, journalism, and music composition. On the other hand, there's this.
Last week, two African-American men were arrested in a downtown Philadelphia Starbucks.
The clip shows police officers confronting two black men seated inside the Starbucks as they wait for a third guest. The store manager reportedly called police after the men asked to use the bathroom without buying anything first. Police officers eventually handcuff both men and force them to leave.
Following the arrest and outcry, Starbucks announced all stores will close for an afternoon in May to conduct racial bias training, action that could cost the restaurant chain several million dollars in losses. Starbucks says the manager who called the police on the men has left the company. Joining me now is someone who could talk about both of these stories. Professor Brian Gilmore teaches social justice law here at Michigan State University, and he is also a poet. Welcome to Current State, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll talk about Kendrick Lamar's achievements in a few minutes, but first, you are authoring an op-ed about the Starbucks situation in Crisis Magazine next week. So what went through your mind when you saw the two men, or the video of the two men being arrested?
Of course, it struck me on a personal level, because things like that has happened to many black men. I won't say all, I can't speak for all, but it happens to a lot of black men on a pretty regular basis. But then I began to think about what would be coming is because it's a pattern here to just react to these social media incidents and everybody gets angry and they tweet it and they send it around. What can be achieved out of this?
On Thursday, one of the men who was arrested said an Associated Press article that he actually feared for his life as the police were taking him away. For people who may be skeptical, do you understand what he was saying and why?
Yeah. I mean, there's you as a black person, black male especially, I can only speak from that vantage point. I mean, these kind of incidents, you come close to these incidents in your life. I can say that for sure. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and outside of it is a county called PG County, and it was a number of times where we had encounters with the police for reason or no reason. And most of the time we thought that, you know, we could get killed. I mean, like, actually get killed. And they actually have, I had an incident where the PG County police actually were pointing their guns at us saying, don't you know we can kill you? That's the kind of thing that they were doing. This is when I was a teenager. And people report this now. I'm not saying this is all the police or any of that, but black men can relate to that guy's fear. Because it's the whole power dynamic and the whole notion of the society itself. You know, society itself has deemed us guilty of something. Lo and behold, this time these were two guys who came there for the reason they came there. They were well educated. They were there for business reasons, and the story was what it was. And now it's turned into a really big deal and actually an opportunity.
So what do you think of Starbucks' action beyond the public apology, shutting down all their stores to talk about racial implicit bias?
I think that's I actually thought it took great note of that, and I thought that was a good thing, because what we normally get, a company will kind of dig in its heels, or the other one, which is what's happened with the banks who are engaged in this rampant discrimination, is to buy your way out. And that's what Denny's basically did, $54 million. They basically bought their way out. Cracker Barrel bought their way out of what they did. So Starbucks, I think, is saying, we want to say who we are. We say we are committed to social justice. That's what they always have said. Let's act like it. And I think that's what they're trying to do. That's not to say it will work, but I'm totally prepared to let them try to put this on.
We're talking with MSU social justice professor Brian Gilmore. And now let's pivot to what some are calling a profound moment in African-American culture. This week, Kendrick Lamar was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his 2017 album, Damn. The hip-hop artist is the first, outside of the classical or jazz genres, to receive the honor. The Pulitzer Board wrote that the album is unified by its vernacular authenticity and offers affecting vignettes capturing the complexity of modern African-American life. Let's bring back MSU social justice professor Brian Gilmore and bring into the discussion WKAR current sports host and hip-hop music connoisseur Al Martin.
Thank you.
Professor Gilmore, I'll start with you. You are also a poet, so help us understand why it's such a moment that Kendrick Lamar was recognized in this way.
I guess for me, it struck me because I'm a big jazz fan, a Duke Ellington fan from Washington. He's from Washington, D.C. And in 1965, Duke Ellington was denied a Pulitzer, even though there was forces inside were trying to give him one, but individuals denied it to him, basically as a sort of statement against jazz and black music. And Ellington, in his sort of graceful way, said, you know, fate has been kind to me, and he, like, sort of brushed it off. But behind the scenes, he was very angry, and Aaron Copland, the famous composer, was also very angry. And that led to a period where, you know, there wasn't any reconciliation of that until Wynton Marsalis gets his in 97. So this is the culmination to me of 30, 40 years of struggle to make the Pulitzer recognize, you know, all black music in America.
Al, for some people who may not be familiar with Kendrick Lamar's work, explain their promise behind this album, Damn.
Kendrick, I think, has really set himself apart because he is such a master storyteller. And I think when you evaluate Damn, when I first heard it, I said, this is a good album. But it was so loaded lyrically that I said, okay, this is going to take me some time to digest. And to this day, Reg, I am still learning new things about each and every track every time I listen to it. Every single time I listen to this album, it's amazing. But, you know, as the weeks went by and I started to digest track by track, it is a story about life. That's the conclusion I've come to. And the reason why I say that is, I mean, if you look at the track list, you know, from Blood to Feel, Loyalty, Lust, Love, Fear, God, these are emotions that all human beings go through when it comes to our spirituality being tested, when it comes to loving and trying to figure out what love is, when it comes to loyalty and those we have around us and dealing with that and who is going to help elevate us and who isn't going to help elevate us, how to stay humble in life when you have success. These are all things that are individually noted in each and every track throughout this album. I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA. Cocaine quarter piece, got war and peace inside my DNA. I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. Kendrick's album is actually two albums. Depending on the order in which you play Kendrick Lamar's album, either whether 1 through 14 or 14 through 1, it tells a different story. If you play it 1 through 14, it tells a story of a Kendrick Lamar, or if you want to put yourself in this album, it tells a story of someone growing up with their father in their life. 14-1, it tells a story starting off with an individual who has recently had his father pass away. And what that eventually leads to, if you listen to track one in Blood, that finishes off the album, if you listen to it from 14-1, with death. A gunshot is the last thing you hear.
Professor Gilmore, rap and hip-hop have been around for 30 years. Some say Kendrick Lamar is one of the most talented artists in the game. Why?
You know, and I think the trait most of all that strikes me about him, and you see this in a lot of old artists from, say, the 70s when I was a teenager and things like that, is the humility that he presents. And I think he presents himself in a very vulnerable way. And it's not always, hip-hop doesn't necessarily encourage things like humility and to be humble, because a lot of the music that has come out over the years, good music, but it has a tendency to focus on the person, the ego, how good I am and things like that, how great I am. But I think he's more focused on what he can give to his listeners, the ordinary citizen, the ordinary person that you might see on the street who's struggling just like anybody else to try to get through the days. They don't necessarily have to be dirt poor. It could just be a working poor type person. It could be anybody.
Just to piggyback off of what Professor Gilmore just noted, I think that's what's also special in what Kendrick is doing as well, because so many hip-hop artists today don't seek excellence in the craft like they used to, like artists like a Biggie and Pac back in the 90s. And everything is so surface level, and the content is so surface level. Club hits, what's going to sell. It's so amazing when you look at Kendrick, is because he's been able to find the perfect balance. He can put out a track that gets you grooving in the club, but at the same time, you sit back and you listen to the lyrics and you're like, oh my goodness, I'm really having some train of thought here. And he's talking about something deeper than the normal surface level hip hop artist that you hear really dominating the airwaves nowadays. So I think it's so awesome just to see that balance, because I don't think you can name a hip-hop artist that has been able to do that since maybe Pac and Big back in the 90s.
Well, we've been talking about Kendrick Lamar winning the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 2018. I want to thank MSU Professor Brian Gilmore for his perspective and WKAR current sports host Al Martin.
Thank you, Reg.
Thanks.
And if you click on the current state story on WKAR.org, you can hear Al Martin talk about his experience hearing Kendrick Lamar in concert on the MSU campus just a few years ago. For Current State, I'm Reginald Hartwick.
I feel like a chip on my shoulders. I feel like I'm losing my focus. I feel like I'm losing my patience. I feel like my thoughts in the basement. I feel like you're miseducated. Feel like I don't wanna be bothered. I feel like you may be the problem. I feel like it ain't no tomorrow. The world is ended. I'm done pretending. If you get offended, I feel like friends been overrated. I feel like the family been faking. I feel like the feelings are changing. Feel like my thought of compromise is jaded. Feel like you wanna scrutinize how I made it. Feel like I ain't feeling you all. Feel like removing myself, no feelings involved. I feel for you. I've been in the field for you. It's real for you, right?
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. Next Thursday, we'll have our second Pop-Up Stories live storytelling event of the year. This time, we'll be at Impression 5, and the theme will be education. We're still looking for first-time storytellers, so if you're interested, check out WKAR.org to find out how to sign up. Here's a story from our last event at the Capital Region International Airport. The theme was travel, and storyteller Ray Miller shared a humorous account of his trip to Turkey.
In 1999, my wife and I spent 2 days in Istanbul after a cruise. After disembarking and checking into the hotel, it was late morning. It was a classic, exotic, old world place, the Holiday Inn, next to a military base. We asked about city tours that day, and they said tomorrow we have one in the morning and one in the afternoon, none today. But they had a trip to a place to see them make carpets. And we went on that. It was actually very interesting. They did the whole process of collecting the wool and dyeing and hand looming. And that ended in a showroom where they sell you rugs. And one of the clients there said to the salesperson, "It's too expensive for me." And he said, "Oh, yes, I understand," he said, "but let me give you a hint about bargaining." He said, "Never tell a merchant that something's too expensive, because that's like a criticism that he's charging too much for his product. Instead, tell him, this carpet is too valuable for me. Then he knows that you appreciate his product, but you would like to spend less money. The next morning, we got on the bus, and the guide stood up to introduce himself. My name is Verdot. He said, "You'll never remember my name, and that's okay." And I think that's a trick, so you remember his name. But he said, "I'm a professor at the Istanbul University, but my friend, your tour guide is ill today, so today I'm a tour guide." And he was a wonderful man. He answered every kind of question. He loved his home. He loved Istanbul. I asked him dozens of questions through the day, and we had a great time. But he said, "You know, people are afraid here. They've seen the American movie Midnight Express, and they think Turkey is like that. It's nothing like that." At the end of that day, we got to the Grand Bazaar Market, and he said he was leaving, but that we would have about 1 hour to shop at the bazaar before it closed, and that the bus would wait where it was, and we could join the bus again then. As I got off, I asked the bus driver, I said, "If I get mixed up, how do I find this place again?" And he said, "Well, this is the northeast gate for the market." He said, "But any gate that you leave, if you don't find me waiting," he said, "there's plenty of taxis." And I must have looked doubtful. He said, "Oh," he said, "don't be concerned. Everyone has seen the Midnight Express movie, and they're all afraid." He said, "Don't be afraid. Turkey's not like that." That night, for dinner at the hotel, we went down to the hotel restaurant. Big sign, "Mexican Fiesta Night." And we decided we weren't there to have a burrito in Istanbul. So I asked at the concierge desk about restaurants that you could walk to. And he said, "Oh, yes, half a mile. Go past the fence for the military base. You can go to the right or the left, and there's nice restaurants." I said, "Are we going to have any trouble?" He goes, "Oh," he said, "Americans, they've all seen the movie Midnight Express, and they're all so afraid of Turkey, but it's not like that." And I said, no, I've never seen that movie. We don't speak the language at all." He said, "Many tourists, and it's the military base. There's always going to be a waiter that speaks English." And we walked and picked out a nice-looking place, went in. It was owned and run by Italians and served all Italian food. So still no Turkish, but it was very good. That night, the hotel asked that we put our check luggage out in the hallway. So I transferred some things out of my check bag and put them in my carry-on so I could get ready in the morning, because we had to leave at 4 a.m. At the airport, young lady was assisting us, scanning my carry-on. She sees something. She stops. She looks. She opens it up and pulls out my Boy Scout knife. She calls. Two young soldiers come over carrying military weapons, looking very solemn. They come, they take my knife, he opens it up, pulls out the blade. I thought, this is exactly like Midnight Express. He takes the blade, looks at it, and puts it into his hand, and he laughs. He takes it and laughs. He pokes his friend with it, and the friend laughs. Now, this hurt my feelings, actually. I had sharpened this when I was in fifth grade. He then took the knife and drew it across his throat. The young lady laughed. He said something to her in Turkish. They all laughed again. She gave me back my knife. She said, "Please put this in your checked luggage. Have a nice flight." So Turkey is not like the Midnight Express.
Just ahead on Current State, the motivation for the Michigan woman who won the Boston Marathon this week. Plus, what's new at the Flint Institute of Art. That's coming up on Current State. Current State on WKAR. This weekend, the Flynn Institute of Arts unveils two newly constructed multi-million dollar additions. One features galleries for two new acquisitions the FIA received. The other is an arena to watch artisans create works of art from glass. WKAR's Jamie Paisley went to Flint earlier this week and brings us this preview.
For a good 40 minutes now, Brent Swanson has been making a decorative vase. But he's been doing it for an audience.
So I have this handy dandy tool over here that I can just rest it on here, and I give it a light tap and it pops right off. It's not in the box yet, babe.
Brent is the glass program's manager with the Flint Institute of Arts, and he's showing off the new glass arena of the FIA. Underneath a skylight, Brent is heating, shaping, reheating, twisting, and yes, again, reheating his glass with new equipment, while on the other side of a light partition, an audience can sit and watch while Brent explains what's going on with his molten glass. There are even two monitors overhead which show close-ups for each step of Brent's progress.
Those demonstrations, I hope to mimic or utilize techniques that we have in our contemporary glass collection and show the public what we can do as well as what we have, and so that they can bind or meld those two, you know, forces together of seeing and then of seeing the making and then seeing the finished products.
This glass blowing arena, or the Hot Shop, is one of two new additions with the Flint Institute of Arts that they are unveiling this weekend. The other is a contemporary crafts gallery showcasing ceramics and glass collections, gifts to the FIA. It's all part of an $11 million, or at least $11 million so far, expansion project. The lion's share of that money came from an $8.5 million series of grants from the C.S. Mott Foundation. But the timing may seem strange since the FIA broke ground on this project in 2016, during the height of awareness regarding the ongoing Flint water crisis. Neil Haggerty, VP of the Mott Foundation.
My reaction to that is that what happened in this town and the trauma that the community has been put through generated a lot of response, including from our foundation, where we committed $100 million and led fundraising of other foundations and donors around the country to get resources into this community to deal with the health issues, to deal with the infrastructure issues, to deal with the sort of fallout of what's happened. And so we took that very seriously, invested a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of resources, and really changed the focus of a lot of what we had been planning to do, just like everybody else that's involved in this community. But at the same time, as we do all of that, we really feel that the community still needs to move forward, and there's still a future, a positive future for this community. So at the same time that we're dealing with that, we need to make sure that this community has the educational resources that it needs going forward. We need to make sure that it has the arts and cultural and civic infrastructure for the community to grow and move forward. So our feeling was address as deeply and seriously and as committedly as we can of the crisis, and also think about the things that the community is going to need to move forward and think about the future of the community. And in our perspective, arts, culture, the ability to make, craft, be creative are fundamentally important.
For more about the new FIA additions opening this weekend, including the museum's Huntingdon Free Saturdays and the hourly glassblowing demonstrations, visit flintarts.org. For WKAR, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. This week, Washington Township, Macomb County resident Desiree Linden won the women's division of the Boston Marathon. She's the first American woman to win the race in 33 years. This was the music she was listening to earlier this week, just before the race. NPR's Alyssa Chang talks with Linden about the victory that almost didn't happen.
I love it. Okay, I can't decide if that music would pump me up or depress me. Why were you playing that before the Boston Marathon?
Yeah, it is pretty somber, huh?
Yeah.
Shoot.
Is that your running music? What is that?
No, that was my therapeutic, meditative. I just love the rhythm of it. It just set the vibe right. And it was so somber out. Like, it was just miserable out. It just seemed right.
We caught up with the 34-year-old runner, who goes by Des, this morning, just before her medal ceremony.
I'm feeling all right today.
But her victory almost didn't happen. Yesterday was miserable. In the rain, the wind, she thought about bailing out.
I was freezing, and my muscles were tight, and I was like, this is not my day.
But then there was this moment when one of your fellow American runners, Shalane Flanagan, made a porta potty stop, and you decided to slow down so you could catch her up with the rest of the pack afterwards. What was going through your mind when you decided to do that?
Yeah, we had talked about it a little earlier on in the race when I knew I might be stepping off. I said, hey, if you need, you know, help with anything along the way, I'm happy to run through the wind for you and just kind of be a block or whatever you might need. And so she nudged me later and said, hey, I'm going to do the porta potty thing. And I was like, okay, well, I'll try to run you back into the group. And we got back up there, we reconnected. There was just so much pride on the American side this year. We wanted it so bad. 33 years since an American winner. And I felt like there was some team camaraderie out there.
I love that.
Yeah. If you can help someone be in position, sometimes it helps yourself out as well. It wasn't about me for those moments, and it kind of came full circle.
Well, take us to the finish line. I mean, you pass the grandstand. The crowd is madly cheering.
Des London wins in Boston.
Your husband and your coach are there with you.
An American woman wins Boston for the first time in more than 30 years.
That was everything. I mean, it's the moment you dream of during the tough days when you don't want to go out and run. When you're a little kid and you're getting into the sport and you turn the TV and you see the Boston Marathon, you dream about breaking that tape. It was the culmination of years of hard work and years of dreaming and years of never giving up.
I looked at your Twitter feed and I noticed something like a personal mantra at the top of it. I'm going to read it out loud. You wrote, some days it just flows and I feel like I'm born to do this. Other days it feels like I'm trudging through hell. Every day I make the choice to show up and see what I've got and to try and be better. I read that and I was like, I need to print this out and pin it to my office wall. Tell me where these words come from.
That was full on in the moment in the training block. There was a lot of days that I was like, I don't know if I'm going to even get to start this race. Like, this is not going well. It should be going better. And then there was a lot of days where you'd had that glimmer of hope and you go, no, this is exactly on pace. This is the perfect, it's going to plan, absolutely 100%. And I decided to stop thinking about each day so much and just keep showing up. Like, whatever the day gave me, just show up.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of how I attacked the race, too. Once I got over the fact that I wasn't going to drop out, it was like, just show up for one more mile. Show up for one more minute. And that was kind of my mantra throughout this entire build and through the entire race day on Monday.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. Congratulations. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you got it.
That's Des Linden, the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon since 1985.
Lighthouses are one of the Great Lakes' most iconic sites. From the shores of Superior to souvenir stands statewide, you'll spot them everywhere. Michigan's first lighthouse appeared nearly 200 years ago. Lighthouses have protected countless mariners' lives throughout the centuries. Earlier this week, our network partners at the BBC brought us this history of Irish lighthouses in an interview with one dedicated keeper.
I'm Catherine Harvey, and today I'm taking you back to 1987 and the end of an era for one of Ireland's most famous and historic landmarks, the lighthouse on the island of Skellig-Michael. I've been speaking to Richard Foran about his memories of being the last keeper of the light. On the 22nd of April 1987, the very last resident keeper on Skellig-Michael left the island and its famous lighthouse behind.
Suddenly, here you were with a lock and a key, and you were turning the key on the door, and you were walking down the road.
Richard Foran was a lighthouse keeper on the Skelligs for 30 years.
You did 3 8-hour shifts. There was somebody in watch every hour of the day, looking after the light.
And for him, and many others, the automation of Skellig-Michael's lighthouse marked the end of a tradition dating back nearly two centuries.
You were leaving a place that you knew that there had been men on this place for 160 years, day and night, and suddenly you were lifted off in a helicopter and there was no one there. That was a strange feeling, yeah.
The Skellig Islands, 12 kilometres off the coast of Kerry in Southern Ireland, are the most westerly point in Europe, as well as a site of breathtaking beauty, partly due to the wonderfully preserved 6th century monastery. In 1820, it was decided that lighthouses were needed on the larger island of Skellig Michael, due to the number of shipwrecks in the area.
At that time, the lighthouses, they were fixed lights. They didn't flash, so to distinguish the Skelligs from Cape Clear in Cork and Loophead in Clare, it was decided to put two lighthouses on the Skelligs. They blew up sections of the rock and used that as a foundation for the road. It's hard to describe that when I'm talking to you on the radio. You'd really want to see this construction. It is absolutely akin to the Great Wall of China.
It's a very winding road,
isn't
it?
It's a very winding, steep, but still standing there since the 1820s. They lit boat lights on the 4th of December, 1826.
By 1870, a system had been devised to make the lower lighthouse flash by revolving the lens, and the second lighthouse was decommissioned.
Every lighthouse had a character. The Skelligs was three flashes every 15 seconds. So when you were navigating, you would look at your chart and you'd see on the chart, oh, yeah, that's the Skelligs, just three flashes every 15 seconds.
And what colour was the light? Is the light white?
Oh, the light is white, a white light. It was originally candles, of course, and then they used whale oil. In 1909, they built a new lens for the Skelligs, and they, from there on, they were using vaporised paraffin. And they were absolutely fantastic lights, and they were put all over the coast of Ireland up to the late 50s when they were being electrified. There was a fog signal there as well, of course. So when fog came in, you had to go and fire a rocket every 3 minutes.
What do they sound like? Were they very loud?
Oh, that was very loud, yeah. And I can't recall ever wearing earmuffs or having earmuffs wear, yeah. You know.
Richard Foran grew up on Valentia Island, just northeast of the Skelligs, but linked to the Irish mainland by bridge.
Every morning when you went out your door, you were looking at the sea. So it was natural, I think, to follow that train in your life, you know, to be near the sea. And every 2 weeks, the Irish lightship would come into Valentia, bringing out the provisions and changing over the crews on the lighthouses. So it was a part of our life, lighthouse service. My first time going to the Skelligs, I was around 17 years of age and walked up the road onto the Skelligs. The kittiwakes were crying, and it stayed in my mind for the rest of my life. It was so beautiful to listen to this. And then to see all these puffins flying overhead and literally landing within feet of you, more or less taking no notice of you, you know. It was marvellous.
After deciding to become a lighthouse keeper, Richard was stationed at various outposts along the Irish coast before finally joining the crew of Skellig Michael.
There was four keepers, so one keeper would be off and then there would be three keepers on duty at the time. And it was a six-week cycle. So in theory, you were supposed to be relieved every 2 weeks. But that, of course, that never happened because of weather conditions, and especially during the winter. You could never plan ahead that, oh, I'll be home for Christmas, or I'll be home for the new year, or I'll be home for the spring. You just didn't know when you would be home. In actual fact, my daughter was 3 weeks old before I saw her. During the winter time, you were hauled up onto the rock with a derrick.
With a crane.
A crane. So you were depending on the guy in the boat that he could hold the boat steady, and the guy above the top when he dropped down the bosun's chair for you. Once you got on the bosun's chair, you were pretty safe getting up. But coming down was a different story. Yeah. In 1951, there was a fierce storm, and the lantern on the Skelligs is 53 metres above the water. It was broken, and the light was put out. But also on that night, the derrick was washed away, so they were waiting for weeks to get rescued.
And what would you do? You'd have to ration what you ate? Or?
Well, they would have reserved provisions there, you know. They would have a lot of tin stuff, and when you're going out yourself, you would bring out a lot of extra stuff that wouldn't be perishable, you know.
Richard says that although life on the island was often enjoyable, the remote location could cause problems in other ways too.
It was quite common for the drains to get blocked, so you had to make sure that they were always free.
Is the story true about the rocket signals being put in the drains to unblock them?
Well, there's a story about the drain being blocked in the Skelligs with a rocket, but I'm not sure how true that story is. You know? Another thing that was done there that people don't realise, that we had to collect our own water, of course, and this had to be taken off the roof. But most important of all, you had to make sure there was no salt on the roof. You would pour the water on a hot plate on a stove. If it left a white ring around it, then you realised that you couldn't gather that water because it had salt in it. So you had to wait a couple of more hours until the roof was washed down further.
And what kind of things did you do in the evening? Did you have television or radio?
Oh yes. We always had television there.
And did you have much contact with other lighthouses?
Oh, yeah. There would be radios on every lighthouse. Mm-hmm. So you were able to talk all over the coast. Now they were depending on each other's trust, but they would play chess with each other from one lighthouse to the other. I would like to go fishing in the evening if the weather was suitable. You had the monastery if you wanted to go there and were interested in that. Then there's unbelievable wildlife on the Skelligs. I mean, it's one of the great bird sanctuaries of Europe.
What was it like living so closely with other people when you couldn't get off the rock?
Well, you learned, you know, from a young age you had to be diplomatic. Yeah. You would have to accept that every human being you meet is full of faults, including yourself. And you'd be hoping that they would ignore yours like you would have to ignore them.
In 1986, it was decided that all the lighthouses in the area would be automated, starting with Skellig Michael.
Technology had moved on. You had GPS navigation, you had more sophisticated radar systems. We knew it was coming and it was accepted. Somebody wrote one time that not even God alone can stop the flow of time. What has been, and I've had my time, so I'm grateful for that.
Today, the monastery on Skellig Michael is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and the island itself a conservation area, which has helped to make the place a popular tourist destination. And more recently, the Skellig's fame has become astronomical, due to a certain Star Wars franchise.
I was out there when they were doing that because they were using the lighthouse for storing their equipment. But I must say they took great care when they were there and they left the place as they found it. They had the utmost respect for it.
Richard Foran now pilots a ferry, as well as being the operations manager for the Valentia lifeboat station. And although he's left the lighthouse and the islands behind, he says the experience of living and working on Skellig Michael will stay with him forever.
It's unique because of the wildlife, it's unique because of the monastic settlement, and it's unique because of the lighthouse. It was an absolutely marvellous construction to build the lighthouse where they built it. And they left a monument to mankind that certainly, I hope, it will be maintained.
Hope this edition of Current State provided something of a guiding light for your weekend. For the WKAR News Team, I'm Peter Worf. Thanks for joining us. We'll connect with you next weekend on Current State, here on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.